Welcome to Cinema Journal Presents Acamedia. I'm Christine Becker.
And I'm Michael Kackman.
And we're both here at the University of Notre Dame. So welcome back to the podcast. We've got a very special episode for you. We're actually going to kind of clear the decks here and do a special episode due to a really great interview I conducted last month with Neil Verma from University of Chicago. And you may have recognized our music there. That was from the original War of the Worlds radio broadcast. And that's what we want to talk to Neil about. October represents the 75th anniversary of the War of the Worlds radio broadcast. So I talked to Neil about it last month.
It seemed like a good opportunity to go back and revisit that.
Exactly. Yeah. Some fascinating issues for, you know, the study of history, but also the study of the present and media panics and the kinds of things us media studies academics get really fascinated by and really want to dig into.
Absolutely.
So we had a great conversation last month, and so we decided that was going to be the sole focus, our one segment this broadcast. So we'll get back to the usual next month. I'm certain things will be back to normal next month.
I'm sure they will.
No doubt about it. But we'll run Neil's interview for this for the next half hour or so, and because I think it was a really interesting, revealing interview, and Neil is a fascinating guy, so I think everyone will really enjoy this interview. Neil Verma is a collegiate assistant professor in humanities at University of Chicago, where he received his PhD in the history of culture. His areas of specialization include U.S. culture of the 20s through the 60s, sound and sound culture studies, theories of ventriloquism, and science fiction and film noir. His recent book, Theater of the Mind, Imagination, Aesthetics, and American Radio Drama, is published by the University of Chicago Press. And other recent publications include an article on the radio plays of Lucille Fletcher and a chapter on eavesdropping in film noir. Among other projects, he's currently collaborating with Northwestern's Jacob Smith on an anthology about Norman Corwin's 70-year career in national and international broadcasting. Hello, Neil. Welcome to the Acamedia podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. We appreciate you taking the time and really looking forward to a conversation here. And, you know, it's most common to talk about War of the Worlds, the radio broadcast, as a cultural phenomenon, and we'll certainly get to that. But I'm intrigued by your work on radio dramas as aesthetic objects, and in particular your book, Theater of the Mind, Imagination, Aesthetics, and American Radio Drama, which, by the way, was winner of the Best First Book Award from SEMS. So congratulations on that.
Thanks.
The blurb says it's an aesthetic history of 6,000 classic U.S. radio plays. So I'm wondering if you could first share with us some of your knowledge about classic radio drama aesthetics. What were some of the defining characteristics of how these dramas told their stories?
I got interested in radio drama about 7 or 8 years ago. And what I was really interested in was a series of different gothic and suspense programs from the late 40s. And it sort of puzzled me why it is that interiority of various kinds is so compelling as a subject in the late 1940s. And so I did some writing around that, and then I realized that, you know, I really had to go further back into history with this form and try and figure out how this particular approach developed. And so I started listening to a lot of different programs of the mid-30s, so the Cavalcade of America, The March of Time, the Mercury Theater broadcast, which was Orson Welles' start as a director, the CBS workshop, and what I noticed was that these dramas weren't about interiority at all. Like, there's very little things like stream of consciousness or kind of psychological gothic. I mean, there were ghost stories, but there's no real kind of insideness to these plays. On the contrary, there's a huge amount of outsideness. So when you listen to, you know, the way these plays actually sound, they're really going out of their way using sound effects, filters, amplitude, things like that, to construct exterior environments and to move us around in them quite quickly. So I started to think about this and, you know, develop a few analytical terms I could use to explain it. Also, if you're writing a book, you need to invent analytical terms or else one's going to take you seriously. Yeah. So I thought about, you know, one thing that's important to listen to, especially in dramas of the 30s, the dramas that Orson Welles was listening to and taking part in, is to think about where you are according to what you hear in the world of the drama. Because this is something that directors really paid a lot of attention to, and this comes across in all their writing. And so I thought that, you know, a good term to use would be this term audio position, which I write about in the book, which is just that. Where am I according to what I hear? And so it's actually just a helpful way of thinking, well, how do I unpack this radio drama? So that's one thing. One thing is that directors are tending quite closely to where the listener is according to what they hear. And that's important to all of Wells's work. The other thing I'd say is that there's a couple of styles that sort of emerge, aesthetic styles, around this issue of positioning the listener. One of those styles is what I call the intimate style. And this is sort of the notion that we spend most of the drama close by some other being who tends to be moving in deep space. And the intimate style is extremely important for a lot of Wells' work, but also for a lot of kind of routine narrative problems. How do you build suspense in the shadow? Well, you tell people that there's an inside and an outside, and then you explain to them that a fire is about to happen. So a lot of dramas use that. On the other hand, there's also an equal number of dramas, especially news broadcasts, broadcasts that are about occasions, celebrations, patriotic broadcasts, populist broadcasts, that don't sound like that at all. Rather, we're segueing very rapidly from one scene to another scene. Most of these scenes are pretty shallow. Okay, so I call this a kaleidosonic sound. It's very evident in news broadcasts, very evident in kind of the famous World War II broadcasters like Norman Corwin. So these are the kind of aesthetic language in which a drama like The War of the Worlds emerges.
Well, and as you're talking, I sort of what you're saying echoes a lot of things and very varied things in War of the Worlds, which is partly why I think aesthetically it's so interesting. It goes to literally a lot of places, but also sort of sonically, a lot of different aesthetic techniques. So where do you see War of the Worlds fitting into your scope of this trajectory of aesthetics in radio drama?
Most of the radio dramatists whose work has endured use both of these two styles that I've talked about. So Norman Corwin is a great example. A lot of his dramas will oscillate quite quickly between these two different styles, often in order to tell kind of historical stories. A lot of other radio dramatists will use one style or another. So Archibald MacLeish is a good example. His first major radio drama is The Fall of the City, which Orson Welles was the star of. And that's a very intimate drama. We spend the entire play right next to this correspondent on the city. You know, they're debating what to do about this conqueror who's coming. And then his other major radio drama, Air Raid, which Orson Welles listened to the day before they broadcast The War of the Worlds, is much more kaleidosonic. So it segues from place to place. Often there's a kind of narrator who's like the voice of time, who's kind of telling us where we're going from place to place. And The War of the Worlds is the same. The first act is definitively kaleidosonic in its structure, right? A lot of scenes, a lot of shallow scenes. It also has, it's actually a fascinating way of subverting that whole genre as well, because it kind of collapses in on itself. Kaleidosonic dramas are often very orderly. And the end of the first act of The War of the Worlds is extremely disorderly. You can actually read the end of that sequence as the eradication of audio position, right? There is no place in the drama for us to be because there's no outside of the drama. And then the second half, which almost no one ever talks about, is entirely intimate, right? We have this character narrator, Professor Pearson, and we're following him in deep space over a duration of time. So that, I think, accounts for the stylistic differences between these two chunks of the drama. It's not the only way you can think about it, but I think it's a helpful one.
What do you think Wells was going for in having the two different segments then? What is supposed to be the kind of takeaway from the two?
Well, the rhetoric, if you like, of the kaleidosonic style is it's very much about moments in time, right? Whereas the other is, the intimate style is much more about exploring space. So when you use a rhetoric that is much more about a moment in time, you can have a lot of things happen very quickly. And Orson Welles' first job in radio was almost his first job in radio was on The March of Time, the news program. He played Fiola LaGuardia. He played Sigmund Freud. I know, huh? And so he was used to these kinds of dramas where you have a series of modular scenes. So I think that he deliberately adopted it. And, you know, you can tell from his dramas that he did just before this one, especially his Julius Caesar, which was one of the early plays of the fall season that year in 1938, where he had a news broadcaster, H.V. Kaltenborn, who would set up different scenes. He's already experimenting in that play with making it sound like the news, right? Mm-hmm. So if one of the reasons why people panicked is that it sounds like the news, it's because the news had this kind of kaleidosonic quality to it. I think that's kind of a bit of a cop out of a total explanation as to what happened, because in the 1930s, most of the news that people listened to were dramatization, right? So it's not quite right to say that just because it sounded like the news, people thought it was real. But there is something that Wells was deliberately trying to do, and you know, we know that these were the instructions he gave to John Houseman, the producer, and Howard Koch, the writer, wanting to make it sound like a newscast.
Chris, I'm sorry to interrupt your interview, but I just wanted to let you know, I just stepped out of the room here for a minute while that interview was playing, and I don't know, there's something a little bit strange going on. You should hear this. Take a listen to what I just overheard Jim Collins talking about in his class.
Okay.
What I'm suggesting is, what happens if we try to use Blue Velvet as a quantum model of human subjectivity? Let's map it as follows. Let N equal Frank Booth, C equals nitrous oxide, and X of Y equals Pantone 17-4139 TCX Azure Blue. If we calculate the drag coefficient of the human ear as 0.39, where F is the drag force, which is by definition the force component in the direction of the flow velocity, we can infer that Isabella Rossellini is there's something sticky in my hair.
Now, I'm not sure where that's coming from.
That was what?
It's a little odd. And you know, Mary Kearney just passed me in the hallway, and she said I don't know quite what she was talking about, but she said something about rebooting her feminist media criticism class this semester.
Uh-huh.
She's decided that she's completely rethought it, and she's reorganizing it around the men's rights movement. She's apparently setting up guest lectures from Charlie Sheen and Seth MacFarlane.
Really?
Yeah.
And to give them a platform, you're saying?
Well, I think so. I think she feels like they're just not getting enough voice.
Is something in the water here?
I don't know. I think maybe it's just they're getting to that midpoint in the semester and everybody starts getting a little punchy. So maybe they're just trying to keep people on their toes.
Well, maybe we'll get back to the interview and maybe you can look into this.
I'll see what I can find out.
Maybe get Bill on this
Yeah, we could get him going on this.
Okay.
Will do.
All right, let's get back to the interview then. Yeah, I'd like to dig into just a little more detail about the broadcast itself and how it played out. So to set that up, let's listen to a clip for our listeners who haven't heard it. We'll put the full version on our website, but just listen to get a little taste of what this broadcast sounded like.
We are bringing you an eyewitness account of what's happening on the Wilmoth Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. We now return you to Carl Phillips at Grover's Mill.
Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the fires, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. It's coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission. However, we will return to that point at the earliest opportunity. In the meantime, we have a late bulletin from San Diego, California. Professor Indelkoffer, speaking at a dinner of the California Astronomical Society, expressed the opinion that the explosions on Mars are undoubtedly nothing more than severe volcanic disturbances on the surface of the planet. We continue now with our piano interlude.
And so, Neil, can you take us a little bit through the timeline of the broadcast then and how it played out?
Sure. So the broadcast began as a script that was written in 6 days by Howard Koch. In the days just up to the broadcast of the play, there was a lot of skepticism as to whether or not this piece even worked, and a lot of editing that went into it. It was a very intense process to create the play, and a lot of people were involved. There's dozens of actors, there's a 23-piece band, there's, I think, 3 or 4 different sound effects artists, one of whom was Ora Nichols, who's the kind of founding mother of all radio sound effects, who was working that night. So the broadcast starts with this piece by Tchaikovsky that all of the Mercury Theater plays start with, and then Wells gives this kind of famous great monologue about how complacent humans were and how, while we were being complacent, the Martians were scrutinizing and studying us, you know, from afar and drawing their plans against us. And then we kind of segue into this very banal scene. It's not really a scene, it's more like a broadcast of a broadcast, right? Of an announcer introducing Ramon Raquello and his orchestra, who's playing this tango called La Comparsita, which Wells chose because he thought it was very tedious, and he's right. And from there, the kind of play goes on. We have a series of, it seems like, light evening fare that is constantly interrupted by a series of events. We're taken to Grover's Mill, where the scene of the Martian landing takes place. Eventually, the radio broadcast ends, and it seems to be taken over by military frequency, shortwave bands. The Secretary of the Interior comes on. This was actually a last-minute change, because originally they wanted to have an actor playing Franklin Roosevelt, but they thought, well, you can't play Roosevelt. So they came up with the Secretary of the Interior, but Wells would make sure that the actor knew that, you know, actually just play as Roosevelt, we'll just call him the Secretary of the Interior. Anyway, so while that's going on, a bunch of people outside across the country, this is a national broadcast, are hearing, kind of out of the corner of their ear sometimes, this strange series of events. Now, this is a country where more people have radios than have indoor plumbing. There's something like 80-85% of all Americans have access to radios. They listen to it for about 4 hours a day, but they don't listen to it in the way that you pay attention to a novel or pay attention to a movie. You know, often it's kind of background. So it's a background thing that's going on out there. So a couple of minutes into the broadcast, when the Martians start landing and coming out and killing people with poison gas and heat rays and such, phone calls and telegrams and emergency communications start coming into CBS, also to a bunch of different organs, newspapers, local police offices, of people trying to figure out what's going on. A lot of people think that the Nazis are attacking. A lot of people think that, you know, this is sort of real. There's a kind of general fear of the unknown that kind of gets tapped into. This is sort of the idea that a lot of people say about it. A lot of the stories we have of these events are kind of colorful. So there's a lot of stories of people jumping in their car and driving through their lawns or through their driveway doors. A lot of people taking all their money and running to go buy a bus ticket as far as they can. Both during the broadcast and subsequently, there's this interesting character of the weeping sorority girl that often comes up. The weeping sorority girl, yeah, who sort of is either with her boyfriend or with the other girls in the sorority and kind of lamenting that they'll never get to grow up. There's a religious dimension to a lot of these stories. So like a famous story in Indianapolis, a congregant in a church comes in and says, oh, you know, don't bother, you're all going to die. You know, there are mobs in the streets. Now, a lot of people almost die, but no one actually dies. And this is important, right? You know, obviously not just for the reason that we don't want anyone to get hurt, but also, you know, imagine if someone actually had died in this scenario. I think that a lot of the people who were in the War of the Worlds broadcast went on to fame and fortune. That might not have happened if someone had actually been seriously injured. So anyway, all this is happening, and all these messages are coming into CBS headquarters, and they're actually coming through to the broadcast booth. So this is what they sometimes call...
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is what they sometimes call the reverse hoax of the broadcast. Orson Welles thinks that there are bodies piling up in the streets, you know, and so, and you get a sense of this, you know, there's an intermission about 40 minutes into the broadcast, and this is when a lot of these reports come into the booth, and so you hear in the subsequent narration a lot of improvised moments where they're talking about, oh, this is not real, we're just having fun with you, and they think that this is a horrible thing. The police show up, and so when the play ends, they're taken in for interrogation, turned over to the press, who write these sensational stories the next day. And Wells and Houseman, and I think Koch as well, no, Koch was at home, he was asleep the whole time. What Wells and Houseman, they tell this story, which doesn't mean it's true, but they both tell the story, of sort of stumbling out you know, dazed after being interrogated by the press and the cops, and saying, you know, they expected to walk out of CBS and see, like, looting and burning and bodies in the streets, and they were kind of shocked to see it was pretty much not like that at all. So anyway, and this turns Orson Welles into this amazing showman, right, who achieved by accident what no one could achieve by design. And so, you know, the story of Welles told throughout that week, every major newspaper has carried stories about this for several days. And the kind of legend mushrooms around him. I mean, he thinks that the whole thing was funny. It's true. His favorite story about it was that John Barrymore, who was his idol as an actor, heard the broadcast and was also taken in by it. So here's poor Barrymore. He thinks it's the end of the world, and so what does he do? He releases his favorite dogs. He takes all of his beloved dogs and he says, "Go be free, you know, because you've only got hours to live. So, you know, who am I to hold you?" And when Welles thought this was the funniest thing in the world, and he would tell this story the rest of his life. And so this is sort of what I'm telling, what I think is important for media studies people to think about, is that, you know, we should avoid the humorlessness that I think can sometimes creep into our own tactic of aggrandizing the event. Like, I think Welles thought it was funny. I think a lot of people kind of did a little bit of a facepalm and were like, "Oh, you got me in." And that was a big part of, I think, the overall effect of it. Anyway, and so Welles and Houseman and Koch, they, you know, got the most important thing that you can get in radio in 1938, and that's a sponsor. So Campbell's Soup begins to sponsor the broadcasts, and they go on for another 6 or 7 months, and then come back now and then while Welles is in Hollywood. But, you know, it ultimately, I think, was a great event for radio.
Chris, I'm really sorry to interrupt again, but I wanted to bring in this report from Bill Kirkpatrick from Santa Cruz.
Hi, this is Bill Kirkpatrick. I'm on the campus of UC Santa Cruz talking to Professor Herman Gray about the issue of race in War of the Worlds and in general about the contested space of radio and television, television in particular, as a space for contesting racial meanings. Professor Herman Gray.
You know, I've been studying what is race. I don't ever recall. I don't know anything about race or television where the images of black people or brown people exist on, I don't know anything about that.
Michael and Chris, I'm going to send it back to the studio from Santa Cruz, California. This has been Bill Kirkpatrick with Professor Herman Gray.
So maybe it's not just at Notre Dame?
Is there something? I'm not sure. And in fact, listen to this clip of what sounds like Will Brooker that was just recorded from the BBC in London.
Are there any bad effects of comic books? I might say here on this subject, there's practically no controversy. Anybody who's studied them and seen them knows that some of them have bad effects. It's my opinion, without any reasonable doubt and without any reservation, that comic books are an important contributing factor in many cases of juvenile delinquency. This is a public health problem.
We're going to have to explore this further. But
this is, I'm starting to freak out a little bit. This is...
I'm sure it's nothing.
All right.
Let's just get back to your interview.
Okay. All right. So you said Orson Welles wanted this to sound like a real news broadcast, and I presume he was hoping this would scare people, but did he envision the reaction it did generate in any way? Was that what he was hoping for?
Okay, so here we have the moment in the story where everyone involved, their story changes depending on when you ask them.
Really?
So here's what's for sure. It's definitely true that Orson Welles decided to, he was just the one who decided that this should be the play they do. He assigns it to Howard Koch, who is relatively new at the Mercury Theater, relatively new as a playwright. And he hates the assignment. He thinks it's really hard to do. A lot of the stuff he just, you know, kind of pulls out of the air. One famous story is that he picked the setting Grover's Mill just by kind of randomly pointing his finger at a map of New Jersey. But, you know, he doesn't feel as if this is a really worthwhile pursuit. And actually, everyone involved in the play has incredible doubts about it as an effective piece of drama. They think it's very boring. They're not sure if the audience will get it. Also, I'm not convinced that they can really predict the audience reaction in the way that I think retrospectively we imagine that they do. I mean, one of the main reasons why a lot of people panicked is that they didn't hear the introduction of the play that Orson Welles does as a kind of exterior narrator. And the reason that a lot of people didn't hear it is because they were tuned into Edgar Berg and Charlie McCarthy show on another station. So, you know, it strains credulity that he would have timed things so that people would listen to the opening monologue of Edgar Bergen and then tune over to the Mercury Theater. It certainly in the days afterward, he claimed that it was all a kind of accident. It's not until later on in life when he starts to view this as a kind of great moment in his history and his reputation and part of what makes him who he is. It's not until then that he starts to give interviews and talks where he says, well, we kind of knew that this was going to happen. And, you know, we weren't dummies, you know, we were playing with fire. So, you know, it's a complicated answer. I feel like he does want it to sound like news for aesthetic reasons. He's not the only person who makes radio dramas that sound like news. If he intended to step over the line, I find that kind of hard to believe. But another way of thinking about this is that The War of the Worlds isn't really about what really happened. It's about what we say about what happened. So in that case, I think that we should kind of subscribe to the hoax idea.
Right. Well, speaking more to that, then that's, as you say, that's sort of the most famous aspect, perhaps, is the mythologies
right.
tied around to this and the fun people have had with perpetuating those. So what are, to you, some of the most interesting mythologies to come out of the broadcast, and how and why have those gotten perpetuated over time?
I mean, this is kind of the question, really, when it comes to this broadcast. So maybe I'll start with what we know is relatively certain. So we think about 6 million people listen to the broadcast. And about 1 million, little more than 1 million, kind of were worried or panicked a bit. And in a country of 130 million people, this isn't a huge audience. Mm-hmm. I should also say there's a level of dubiousness to these statistics. They're largely based on Crossley Service and Hooper ratings that were kind of employed by social researcher Hadley Cantrill, who wrote this important book, The Invasion from Mars in 1940, about the panic. Now, the Hooper ratings and the Crossley Service are like the Nielsen ratings of the day. But the problem is that nobody believes them. I mean, if you read the trade literature of this time, Printers Inc., Variety, I mean, week in and week out, every single person is complaining about these statistics because they don't agree, they don't think the methodology is very sound. So even people in the industry thought this was kind of a bit uncertain. Anyway, so that's what we think happened. A big part of us remembering it starts in the hours and days after the broadcast, where a lot of sensationalist news reports come out. I also think that part of our memory has to do with not just the hoax, but also with this theory of the primed audience. Mm-hmm. That I think almost everyone in the 40s and 50s would sort of talk about when they talked about the broadcast, which is to say that, you know, this is right after the Munich crisis, and a lot of people are kind of jittery, worried about war coming. And so the war broadcast gives them a way to express these nerves. Also because it was near Halloween, so a lot of people feel that superstition had something to do with it. But I feel like, you know, in media studies, we get an awful lot of traction out of this primed audience idea. You know, mm-hmm. one thing that the radio age did is it made vivid the notion of a susceptible listener as something that can be studied and quantified and sometimes sold. So it's not surprising that a lot of early communication studies work on this tends to exaggerate the panic because it kind of aggrandizes the project of communication studies at the time. So I think that's one thing to say about it. Another thing to say about it is that whole line of, you know, following the susceptible listener, it kind of combats the humor. You know, is there something very humorlessness about it? I mean, if you listen to Orson Welles' interviews about this subject, part of which is in, I think a lot of your listeners will know, F is for Fake has a segment where he talks about the broadcast. And, you know, he thinks it's kind of funny, right? And I actually think a lot of people who were panicked also think it's kind of funny. Mm-hmm. We've kind of built up this mythology around it. I mean, you know, Andre Bazin's book on Welles has these wild claims that don't never actually happen. People committing suicide, miscarriages. But nevertheless, a lot of things did happen, right? There were lots of reports of fires, people in Grover's Mill shooting at water towers, geologists running into the night with flashlights. People in Boston would stand on their rooftops and look for the fires of New York in the distance. Anyway, so I think a lot of people, you know, did have this kind of feeling of jitteriness, but a lot of people also kind of felt they enjoyed that feeling. And, you know, I think that we're kind of doing the wrong thing if we just indulge our own fantasy of the relentless power of the media, mm-hmm. you know? Not a catastrophe, not even really a hoax, but an extremely interesting event that tells us something about our own attitudes towards mediation and has consistently been such for 75 years.
Yeah, and that consistency, I just thought of, you know, why it would resonate so much today, that there's obsessions with what is real, with the spread of misinformation about
right.
Twitter, about, you know, having moral panics about video game violence, and
right.
Can see this being something that keeps getting kind of repurposed for new media ages and thoughts about kind of the spread of this information and how people react. So I could really understand how it would still resonate in that way today.
Yeah, you know what I was thinking about just the other day is that there's a kind of interesting parallel between this and, you know, the fake panic or the kind of myth of the panic, the Lumiere brothers' arrival of a train. You know, Tom Gunning has this famous essay where he talks about this, where there's this story that when the Lumiere brothers premiere the arrival of a train in Paris, that the audience freaks out and they run away because they think that the train is real,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, the myth of that happening is much bigger than what actually happened. But Gunning has this important point in his essay where he talks about, we can decide, okay, well, this was a myth and then discard it. Or we can decide, wait a minute, this is an allegory. If we think of it as an allegory about susceptibility, about mediation and immediacy, about the verisimilar and the real, then it becomes this incredibly rich node for thinking. And I think that's the right approach to this. You know, it's an interesting event, right? Rather than something that did happen or didn't.
Chris, I'm really, really sorry to break in here again, but I just got an audio file emailed to me from someone who claims to be a student in Henry Jenkins' fan studies class.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently completely went off on them. Take a listen to this.
You know, before I answer any more questions, there's something I wanted to say. Having received all your letters over the years, and I've spoken to many of you, and some of you have traveled, hundreds of miles to be here, I'd just like to say, get a life, will you people? I mean, for crying out loud, it's just a TV show. I mean, look at you. Look at the way you're dressed. You've turned an enjoyable little job that I did as a LARP for a few years into a colossal waste of time. I mean, how old are you people? What have you been done with yourself? You must be almost 30. Have you ever kissed a girl? I didn't think so. There's a whole world out there. When I was your age, I didn't watch television, I lived. So move out of your parents' basement. Get your own apartments and grow the hell up. I mean, it's just a TV show, damn it. It's just a TV show.
So, I, oh my God, what is going on here? I think we need to get, you know, Bill on this even more.
Actually, Bill is working on it.
Is he?
I think we can bring him to us right now. I believe he's in Madison, Wisconsin now.
Okay, so he's got a follow-up report for us?
Yeah, Bill, can you paint us a word picture?
So, Michael and Christine, I'm speaking now with Michelle Hilmes to see if she has some reaction to the strange remarks from Henry Jenkins. Professor Hilmes, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
So you've heard about Henry Jenkins' strange outbursts, and I was wondering, as a colleague of his, whether you have any ideas about what might be going on. Is this something we should be worried about?
Well, I've spoken to Henry recently. He seemed fine to me. I don't know what's come over him, but we were discussing some online teaching. He seemed perfectly normal.
Online teaching, you say?
Yes, that's right. We were thinking about MOOCs and similar types of experiments, and he seemed perfectly rational to me.
So no idea where this might be coming from. I guess it's an isolated incident then. We don't have to worry about it. We can continue as normal then.
I would think so. I mean, everything's going on just as it has been.
Okay, well then, as long as I've got you on the line, I was wondering if I could ask you a little bit about your latest research on radio and what you're up to in that regard.
On what?
On radio, your work on radio studies.
Radio? That medium went out with TV. Seriously, who would waste their time on something without pictures?
Professor Hilmes, I'm surprised to hear you say that. After all, I thought that you thought that radio was an important medium, isn't that?
If you're stuck in your car in traffic, you might punch a few buttons on the dash, I suppose. But, you know, only if you forgot your iPod or there's nobody to text to kill the time. Who wants to listen to someone drone on and on without pictures? You know, video, graphics, something. Radio is over. Didn't you see my Facebook post about this?
No, I guess I must have missed that. Well, that's, I guess that's an interesting new perspective from Professor Hilmes. I guess, Christine and Michael, I'm going to throw it back to you in the studio.
Bill, can you offer a further explanation of that? Bill?
Huh.
Bill?
I'm starting. Yeah,
we've lost him.
I think we've lost everybody. What is going on here?
It's entirely possible.
Okay, well let's get back.
We're going to keep working
interview.
On this.
We'll follow up on this for you. We're going to get back to the interview. Speaking of then the current age, you are helping to direct a variety of anniversary events, including a series of blog posts at Antenna and Sounding Out, and we'll put links to those on our website. But also, I'm very intrigued, you're planning a live tweet of the broadcast on October 30th. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about these events, what value you're hoping to mine from them, what you think we can learn from these particular aspects and filtering this War of the Worlds 1938 media event experience through 21st century media and participatory culture.
One of the most interesting things about the War of the Worlds is how it's been thought of over time. There were new versions of it, one done in Ecuador in 1949, another one done in Buffalo in 1968. There were the films, the 1953 version by Byron Haskin, and I think a lot of your listeners will know the 2005 Spielberg version. A lot of TV versions, or TV, like television broadcasts that are about the panic. But when I was looking at all this stuff, I thought, I wonder how we should think about it today. What's the most appropriate way to commemorate this, you know, perpetually commemorated panic? And I thought that, you know, it would be interesting to do something that recreates the kind of mass audience of the radio age in a small way, but at the same time hybridizes that with some of our own media reception practices today. So we came up with this kind of harebrained system of events. And this is myself, Jennifer Stover Ackerman from SUNY Binghamton, Andrew Bottomley from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Aaron Trammell from Rutgers. The first thing we came up with was this notion of a web series. So it's a 12 or 13 part series, we're not quite sure yet, that started in August and is going to go through till January, that's running in parallel on Sounding Out, which is the Sound Studies blog that I think a lot of your listeners will know, and also the Antenna blog at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we've got a bunch of authors, people like Deborah Ray Cohen from University of South Carolina, Michelle Helms, Murray Pomerantz, Jake Smith from Northwestern, all writing about either the War of the Worlds itself or about other broadcasts in the Mercury Theater series. So we call it From Mercury to Mars. And that kind of spawned this idea of doing a live event for the actual anniversary on October 30th, which it should be about 8 p.m. Eastern. And so we got in touch with WHRW Radio at SUNY Binghamton, and they expressed interest in doing a broadcast. So we ended up with this three-hour chunk of time. And in the first hour, we're going to have a bunch of different media studies scholars, Kate Lacey from Sussex, Paul Heyer, who wrote a book on Wells and radio, from Wilfrid Laurier, Alex Russo from Catholic University. They're going to kind of set up the broadcast, and then from 8 o'clock to 9, we're going to play the original. And afterwards, we'll have a few events, but we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could actually get people to listen, classes, artists, professors, just fans, and to react to it using a common hashtag across different social media. So we came up with this idea of the hashtag WOTW75, and so we want to create this kind of social media event around the anniversary that we could subsequently archive. I mean, one of the great things about the War of the Worlds is that we know more about this audience than perhaps any other radio play audience in history because of all the studies that were done of it. So it's left this kind of residue of reactions. And we want to do something similar. We want to create some kind of residue of reactions so that people will be able to understand what it was like to listen to the War of the Worlds in 2013. I think it might tell us something, you know, I'm not quite sure what it is. When the people who made the War of the Worlds got together in the broadcast studio in 1938, they didn't quite know what they were doing either. So
that's inspirational, though.
Yeah, it is. And so we're patterning ourselves after this valiant this valiant effort, you know, trusting the unknown. So hopefully it'll yield something that'll be interesting.
Chris?
Yeah?
I'm really sorry.
Yeah?
We have to interrupt this again because, okay, now it's not just, I'm sending audio clips.
I'm checking my Twitter feed, too.
Yeah,
dude,
what's
are you
on there?
Seeing, oh my God, we've got Jen Holt is tweeting that the FCC should be eliminated because the industry has suffered enough from heavy regulations.
Oh, whoa, check this out from at Amanda Lotz. New job at CBS. Finally, network TV is back.
Oh, my God. I got Kevin Heffernan on Facebook. He's posting brony memes. Brony memes.
Ew.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I've got another audio clip I think we need to share here.
Okay.
You guys can just listen to it. I think this is Jason Mattel.
Okay.
America is just so weird in what they think is right and wrong. Like, I was watching Breaking Bad the other day, and they were cooking meth. I could literally cook meth because of that show. I mean, people watch that show and they can just copy it. What is TV doing to us? Just think of the children. Breaking Bad, I just got into, but I haven't been able to keep up with it as much. There's just a lot of him coughing. I'm in the first season and the coughing is driving me crazy. Like, we get it. You're dying. Do you really need a whole 2-minute scene of another cough attack? It's just too much. In every bad situation, how does he get out? He just starts coughing. So I think I'm going to start Downton Abbey next, but I don't know if it's my vibe. I always thought that shit was too hipster.
Okay, hang on a second here. I'm trying to read more tweets. I'm trying to process all this stuff. Just give us a second here. This is a true stunner. I mean, this is, you know, I can't even process this. David Bordwell, on his blog, has put up a blog post, a 5,000-word blog post about how he is moving to France and undergoing psychoanalysis so he can better understand himself and psychoanalysis as a film theory.
Look at this. He's just announced himself on Twitter.
Twitter? Bordwell's on Twitter?
Yeah. Whoa, check out that handle. I guess if we want to follow him.
Mm-hmm.
Just look at @objah.
Oh,
whatever that
God.
Means.
All right. Well, I have the game ender right here too. Barb Klinger on Twitter, she's just tweeted she's dissolving SCMS. And I quote here from this tweet: "The Hollywood Reporter and the Rap have the industry covered. We're done here." Michael, are we done? Is this? Are we seeing the end of media studies here?
There's something going on here.
Okay, we'll go back to the interview. We'll, you know, keep carrying on with Neil.
All right, I'll see what I can find in the meantime.
And one random aside I wanted to ask, you said that many people tuned in late to the War of the Worlds broadcast because they were listening to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. And
right.
I had to bring this up because you also list theories of ventriloquism as a research interest. And this always just fascinates me when I'm teaching history of broadcasting, and Michael and I have talked about this, and you get to, you know, ventriloquism on the radio and the students' minds are blown. They just don't understand this concept. So can you explain to us what the phenomenon of ventriloquism on the radio?
I've listened to a lot of the Bergen and McCarthy broadcasts. I think they're quite funny, but I specialize in radio plays, and I'll tell you one thing that's really interesting is that ventriloquists are often killers in sort of suspense plays. And the ventriloquism as a kind of, what should we call it, mode of relationship, is one that a lot of people attribute to the medium itself, right? So the easy answer is, well, you know, the radio itself is ventriloquial, right? It's a voice-throwing mechanism, essentially. So isn't it interesting that, you know, we can also put ventriloquists on the radio? I mean, that's kind of the easy answer, right? The radio is itself ventriloquial. But another answer is that we call radio the theater of the mind, and that's both a trivialization and also a hint of something important. When we say that, we're often saying, oh, well, there's no craft behind it. The listener is constructing everything in their mind. And I guess that's true, but that's also true of a novel. So, you know, it's not quite a satisfying answer. On the other hand, we do listen to this acoustic information and participate in some kind of visualization exercise. And that's a rather sophisticated process. So I think when we're listening to a ventriloquist play, it kind of has a way of tickling that relationship. You're picturing this dummy show in an incredibly sort of vivid and powerful way. And I think people find that really compelling, in part because they realize how visual the experience of radio is. So I guess that's my answer. My answer would be that the ventriloquist act as a phenomenon on radio points us towards the visuality of the medium that we're used to experiencing but surprised to have vivified for us.
Which in turn makes it fascinating to think about people flipping, or whatever you would call it back in the 1930s, switching from listening to that to War of the Worlds. Like that idea of the kind of what we create in our mind seems like a really profound connection between those what might be seen as rather disparate things. And then kind of throwing in the contemporary age to that, this idea of social media and what we can imagine from what we see in social media, which is, you know, it's of course virtual and I'm not seeing the people I'm tweeting with. But what our mind does and can put together with all that is fascinating, kind of fundamental cultural and psychological issues there.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the things that's often said about the kind of McLuhan-esque stream of reasoning about radio is that radio is kind of less than other things. It's less than television. It's less than film. And that minimal quality, I think it shares with things like tweets, right? That it has a kind of coolness to it that gives us the perception that we are in control of some kind of relationship or some kind of image, or some kind of communicative act that a kind of richer, comparatively richer form of medium might not provide one. It's a slippery argument, but there's something to be said about that. Something to be said about the fact that both radio and social media often seem like they're reducing larger things, drawing things down to hints and double entendre and pointing towards other cultural artifacts and objects. And by doing so, they're able to kind of enrich their own narrative field.
And considering how much I enjoy Twitter and social media, you've given me something very intriguing to think about in that regard.
All right, Chris, I'm sorry to come back in here, but
yeah.
Things are getting a little bit more, I don't know, there is definitely something going on here, and I think we're going to need the help of our listeners. Maybe you can get on the Twitter and start putting out the word so that we can kind of figure out what's going on.
Really? I mean, if we're serious about this Twitter, I mean, Twitter's like a total waste of time. Like, it's,
Chris,
you know, yeah, what's it?
Come on, you were just on there. Just,
oh, I've never been on Twitter. I've always thought that was a total pointless waste of time. I mean, we got so many other important, and 140 characters? Can't say anything in 140 characters.
But that's, Chris? All right, I appear to be by myself in the studio now, so I'm going to go ahead and play the closing of Chris's interview with Neil Verma, but this might in fact be her last appearance on the podcast. In the meantime, we're going to solve this thing. I need to get out of the studio. We need to find some guidance on this. I'm going to, you know what? I've got a media studies scholar that I can look up. I think I can figure out what's going on.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion about War of the Worlds. And one last thing. I've heard you've taught an online course, a MOOC, as they're called, about this as well.
Yes. We just finished the first semester, and some pretty prominent media scholars took it. Henry Jenkins, Michelle Helms, Jim Collins, Will Brooker, several others. I'm sure they got a lot out of it, that they'll never be the same again, in fact.
Well, that sounds like a great course. I'll have to take it when you offer it again.
Definitely. We're starting up again very soon. The firm that manages it is this great startup called 2X2L Educational Technologies. They've been very generous meeting my unusual requirements.
Hmm.
You know, I'm convinced that MOOCs are academia's future, and I believe that if you and everyone out there listening right now takes my class, this could change the face of media studies forever. And I'll be watching closely to see that unfold. Perhaps almost as narrowly as someone with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water.
Well, I am now very intrigued, and I can't wait to see what happens. So thanks for your time, Neil.
Thank you, and goodbye, everybody.
I've left the studio now in hopes of getting some guidance from Dr. Terwilliger Pearson, the noted scholar of digital media and pre-Lepsarian quantum mechanics. Professor Pearson, we seem to be experiencing an unprecedented crisis in our field. Scores of scholars appear to be losing themselves, abandoning all that they once stood for. Can you shed any light on this?
Well, it's not really quite as unprecedented as you might think. Why, I recall quite clearly a number of similar ruptures, most notably the evisceration of the ranks of 19th century phrenologists, following a number of high-voltage electrical experiments conducted among the members of the Royal Society of London. It's really a sublime bit of productive chaos, really. I'm reluctant to engage in conjecture, but it may well be attributable to MOOC spores.
MOOC spores?
Oh, yes. Truly marvellous things. They can survive virtually anywhere and are circulated via the luminiferous ether. A robust MOOC wipe can be terrifically productive, wiping out the clutter of thousands of years of accumulated nonsense, making room for
MOOC wipe?
For a completely new metaphysical paradigm. In fact, I'll be starting up a new MOOC of my own, and I'd love to have you participate. It's quite inexpensive, and it provides an elegantly efficient means of reaching thousands. No reading or homework required either. I've been working with some colleagues at the University of Chicago to develop a new MOOC focused on critical pedagogy, and with just a little luck, we should be able to usher in a new era of consciousness. Reports show my student participant count growing at a fantastic rate. One might even say I'm going viral.
Oh, yeah. What are you doing?
Do we have class today?
But really, do we have class today?
I kind of want to go.
Are we going to have class? Like, can we just take a nap?
Professor Kackman?
I don't get it.
Dr. Kackman?
Can we go?
Oh, great.
This is Bill Kirkpatrick. I don't know whether anyone can hear me now. I'm speaking from a student radio station, 2X2L. Skype seems to be down. I tried calling Chris and Michael and couldn't get anyone on the phone. I couldn't even get Chris Becker to respond on Twitter. That's unheard of. This may be the last podcast, but I'll stay here till the end. The collected knowledge of decades of cinema studies, media studies, radio, TV, cultural studies, it's gone. The MOOCs, they've taken it all. This is the end now. 2X2L calling. 2X2L calling. Isn't there anyone in media studies? Isn't there anyone in academia? Isn't there anyone?